Tonight on Arena, many scents of Newark, The Alpinist and The Green Knight are the movies up for review, and we look back 30 years to the release of Nirvana's Nevermind. One 551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start tonight, as usual on a Thursday, with movie reviews. First up will be a prequel to the legendary TV show The Sopranos. The Many Saints of Newark examines the early life of Tony Soprano. Next, directed, written, edited and produced by David Lowery, The Green Knight is a medieval fantasy starring Dev Pastel as Gawain, a nephew of King Arthur, whose adventures see him testing his courage against the eponymous character. And finally, The Alpinist, documentary exploring the exploits of Canadian rock and ice climber Marc-André Leclerc, 23-year-old, winning widespread admiration among his peers for his ability to push the pursuit of alpinism to its near limits. Justin McGregor, Tara Brady have seen all three with me in studio now. And let's start with The Many Saints of Newark. The film is written by the original Sopranos writer, David Chase, directed by Alan Taylor, but stars Michael Gandolfini, son of the original Tony Soprano, James Gandolfini, and Michael playing the younger Tony, which is kind of, there's something really haunting about that. But anyway, let's start, Tara, with where we are in Tony Soprano's life here. What period in time even are we in, I guess?
Well, you ask a good question, because I think there's a, even in terms of the music on the soundtrack and the technology that you're seeing, there's a little, it's not quite consistent. I think there's a few howlers in there if you're being strict, and then of course, because you're dealing with those kind of wise guys, and as with the Rat Pack, they always live perennially in the 50s. You know, they always have that 50s thing going on, so we're supposed to be in the late 60s and early 70s, which doesn't really quite add up for me. I don't think if the show is contemporaneous with the with the 90s when it so, but anyway, but and he's so we have the late 60s, early 70s. Tony Soprano is a high schooler,
In his teens somewhere.
He's not getting on so well at school, as you can probably imagine. And there's a bit of a heart to heart with the school counselor, which is very much like a scene from the TV show later on. It's a kind of sort of pre-shadowing of the relationship that he has with his therapist, which becomes such a central point of The Sopranos. But I suppose the really interesting thing is that if you remember, the first series always had Tony Soprano defined by whatever women were in the room rather than the wise guys around him. So he was, you know, he had this big tyrannical mother who appears here again in younger form, played by Vera Farmiga. And then, you know, then he had his therapist and he had his daughter. Oh. And then there were the various gumas. There were the various mistresses that came in and out over the years as the series ran, and he was like a different person depending on which woman was in the room. And I suppose the big conceit here is that he's a different person depending on what guy. It's kind of bouncing him off these different male role models.
And this is the first real difficulty, I suppose, that we should put up there and front and center, Justin, is can you even talk about this film without referring all the time to The Sopranos, the television series? And what if, you know, you weren't a huge fan, or you only saw the, you know, because this happens where big series goes past and you say, I never really got into that. And then, you know, for people who are saying, I don't know all The Sopranos, I can't remember all of it, even possibly at this stage. Do you need to revise before you go to the film?
You do. You definitely do. I mean, they've made a lot of effort because they're pushing it as a film. They want people to go, you know, that it's a standalone film is kind of the thing that they're saying. But there were so many Easter eggs, so many inside gags. You know, a lot of the actors that are in the series are being played by, obviously, younger actors.
Yeah.
And they're doing, like, bits. They're doing, like, little, you know, body language.
So you need to know the characters from the series to appreciate that.
You absolutely need to know the characters. If you were less than a casual fan, you would not be on the inside of this film. You'd definitely be an outsider.
Tara mentioned there that it's a lot of the blokes around the young Tony that are important here rather than the women that are around him. Who are the men that are around him? Because he's going to have to make a choice about what way he's going to go, isn't he?
Yeah, no, his father is a very small influence in his life. I mean, he goes to prison for a good chunk of his high school, which transitions us from the late 60s to, yes, somewhere in the 70s, wherever that is. And it's really his uncle, Uncle Dickie, played by Alessandro Nivola, who's the one who is drawing him along and really kind of helping him become a made man. But Tony's resisting, which is the interesting sort of take on his character, is he doesn't want stolen goods. He wants to go to college. He doesn't want to mess any of that up. And it's really an origin story of how does that Tony
become the other Tony. Yeah, well, we kind of know
that didn't
work out. Yeah. Exactly. And where does Ray Liotta's character fit into all of that then, Tara?
I'm not entirely sure what I'm supposed to say about Ray Liotta's character because I think I had to sign away part of my soul and flesh on an embargo form on a non-disclosure form. I suppose the thing to say is Ray Liotta's character as Alessandro Nivola's father is a very interesting kind of, he's absolute machismo. If you were a psychoanalyst, you'd say it was pure Freudian id. He has this younger, like ludicrously younger wife, like laugh out loud younger wife. And he's total like appetite. He's there showing the pictures of the wife in a bathing suit to the parish priest and this creature of like pure appetite, not particularly sophisticated in a way where Nivola is actually, he's quite suave and he's quite charming and he has something roguish going on. About him, although that darkens considerably as the film rolls on.
Let's listen to a clip then that features Dickie Moltisanti, played by Alessandro Nivola, his wife Joanne, played by Gabrielle Piazza, is part of this as well, at dinner with the aforementioned Hollywood Dick. This is Aldo, played by Ray Liotta, and his young bride Giuseppina Bruno is also present in this scene, played by Michele De Rossi.
I tell you, Dick, it's paradise over there. On the one hand, you can't believe the beauty. On the other hand, they don't even have toilets. I told you, Giuseppina, that you're gonna live the life of a proud American lady. And I'm gonna have my second set of children with you. And they'll be deluged with a life that they could never even imagine over there. Like you were, Dick, as a kid. These will be your brothers and sisters.
So, Giuseppina is your stepmother, Dickie.
Yeah. Kind of an underlying violence. You feel at any moment in that clip from The Many Saints of Newark that it really could burst out into serious violence, Justin.
Oh, yeah, no, the tempers, they're all on such a short thread, and it's really explosive, especially Uncle Dickie. He goes off a couple of times, but so does Aldo, Hollywood, his father. They just have these hairpin triggers, and it really, there's this tension there, and suddenly it just explodes, and it really is quite striking when it happens and has awful consequences on screen.
The casting of Michael Gandolfini, when you see the pictures, it really does look like what you imagine a young James Gandolfini would have looked like.
He's also very, very good. I mean, he definitely has something. I mean, partly because I think we're so, especially with young actors, we're so used to looking at these very, very identical, you know, like good looking, chiseled, you know, people who are in the gym all day. So when you see someone with an actual face in the way that Hollywood actors used to have, like really interesting features, like you find yourself staring at them. And I find that with him, he definitely has something. He definitely has a presence. Like there's a really, there's something very magnetic about him on screen, even when he's sort of hunching his shoulders and doing that nervy teenage thing while he's kind of stomping around the place and playing a very unsure version of himself. He's very charismatic.
Let's have just to listen to hear him in action, Michael Gandolfini as the young Tony Soprano, and here again he's opposite Alessandra Nivola.
Paradigm of yours is pretty cool.
Yeah, well, they're hot.
I fell off a truck.
Far out, man. Oh.
10-inch woofers.
I want to go to college. I can't get caught with shit like this.
Hey, my friend Hesh says only goys and children pay retail.
This isn't wholesale. It's totally on the arm.
Look, you want to be a civilian? I appreciate that. I'm all for it. But pay attention to me for once, okay? You take the speakers, right? At the same time, you promise yourself these speakers are in. And you say to yourself, this is the last time I'm ever gonna steal something. You stick to it. It's that simple.
Clip there of the of I was going to say the young Gandolfini, Michael Gandolfini as the young Tony Soprano from the film The Many Saints of New York. So does the film work overall? I think we're all in accord that you need to know the Sopranos, you need to know the television series, you need to remind yourself of lots of stuff going on there. Did it work overall for you, Justin?
No, I had there were two things I really had issues with. The treatment of women in the film. You know, portraying misogyny and it becoming misogynistic, it's a really fine line. And I think the film sometimes missed that mark. And also the portrayal of race. Like, we get that, you know, there's an African-American character who works with Dickie, and Dickie's the only one who kind of likes him. And so we get that the rest of the family is racist, but they keep coming back to it. It really becomes quite horrific what they do. I just feel like it was just too hard to watch. Mm-hmm.
Too hard to watch. Stars, yeah. You...
Look, if you're a huge fan of the series, it's Christmas come early for you, yeah. But I think as a film, too.
And what are you saying, Tara?
Yeah, I think if you're a fan, then it's got lots of Easter eggs. It's got like, oh, here's Junior getting his limp and all those kind of things. But unless you're a diehard fan, and yeah, the women are a real problem, and there is, as you say, a fine line between treating women terribly and treating women terribly in your script. So, 3 for me.
3 from Tara as well. Let's move on then to The Green Knight, an adaptation 14th century chivalric poem entitled Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Clocking in at 2 hours and 10 minutes, this one stars Dev Patel, Alicia Vikander and our own Barry Keoghan, among others. Maybe just give us a sense of what that original poem does, Justin, or what it is.
It drew on Irish, Welsh traditions and the French chivalric traditions. And it was the story of one of Arthur's knights, Sir Gawain, and there's a Christmas come and the Green Knight comes in and proposes a game. And the game is, you can do whatever you want to me, but whatever you do to me, I will do to you next Christmas. And Sir Gawain, being all arrogant, decides I'll cut his head off and then that won't even happen. It doesn't kill the Green Knight. So now he knows he has a year to go on. So it's all written in blank verse and rhyming couplets and that kind of thing. So it's been adapted twice before as a film.
Yeah. And David Lowery is the director here. What kind of film might we expect from Lowery, Tara?
Well, he is a very versatile film. I mean, bear in mind, he did go and do a big studio picture. He did Pete's Dragon for Disney, which is one of those big animation to live action versions that they did. His worked really well. It genuinely was magical. It genuinely had it was a genuine old school family film. But generally, his films are it's very, very much lower budget than that. And they tend to be very philosophical. They very often dwell on mortality. And we saw that, you know, with The Old Man and the Gun, which had that fantastic performance by Robert Redford, which was as much about Robert Redford, you know, playing some version of Robert Redford as an old man. And it kept echoing back and parroting back bits of earlier, like younger Robert Redford. And then we had A Ghost Story, which is like a very, very sort of philosophical film about the impermanence of everything. And it has this big killer speech by Will Oldham in the middle of it, pondering the transience of things. And I think that Lowery was going for something like that with here. I mean, it certainly has that element to it. But he spent more than a year in the editing suite trying to cut this together, trying to get this right. The other big factor that we haven't mentioned is Barry Lyndon. He's very clearly, and the scene with Barry Keoghan in particular is a straight lift from Barry Lyndon. So he's going for that idea of the hero that isn't really a hero. Mm. It's, you know, circumstances just sort of contrived to put him in that position. And I'm not entirely sure it works. For one thing, it's nobody can do Barry Lyndon except for Stanley Kubrick. Even with the Irish countryside in the background, and even having spent all that time cutting it together, I don't think he's quite got what he was going for.
The task of putting a poem, an epic poem like this, onto the screen, that is quite a task to undertake. Apart from anything else, it's a big long poem that is for a big long recitation. You mightn't even do it all in one sitting. there's a lot of setting up to be done here.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of setting up and there are a lot of kind of detours, you know, these little, like a road movie. I mean, it really is, you know, a medieval road movie where you have these little moments in, you know, in different, you know, places. And he's obviously chosen the ones that he thinks were best and most representative of the poem. But they just aren't adding up. There's not a sense that it's all coming together and leading towards something. Yeah, it feels like a detour. It feels like you've had to go on a different road to get back to the road you're on. And I think, you know, they say you should never edit your own film. There might be a little bit of proof in that in this one.
Let's have a listen. Dev Patel plays the Green Knight. Plays Gawain here, isn't he? Yeah, he plays the Gawain character. So he's the one that has to be sure he's not around in a year's time when the Green Knight comes back. And here he is speaking to Sean Harris, who's having a Christmas feast at his round table. He is Arthur and Gawain is his nephew.
I recognise, but I do not know thee. I say this not in reproach, but regret that I have never asked you to sit at my side before this day, or upon my knee when thou was newborn. But now it is Christmas, and I wish to build bridges. So, before we make merry, make for me a gift. Tell me a tale of yourself, so that I might know thee.
I have none to tell, King.
Yet. You have none to tell yet.
There we go. The voice of Kate Dickey just at the end there as the Queen, King Arthur, played by Sean Harris, and Dev Patel as Gawain. Obviously not the most vociferous of characters at that point in the story at any rate, Tara. But even that clip, it takes so long to get to the point, doesn't it?
And that's before you get to the countryside and you're just riding around on back roads for a very long time. It is very, I mean, Dev Patel is fantastic. He's really good in a great film like the David Copperfield film from a couple of years ago, and he's really good in bad films like quite bad films like Chappie. Mm. He brings something to this even when it's very very episodic and choppy. But it feels like a film that needs to be a sort of hurried along a little bit. And there are detours that just simply don't work. That whole sort of penultimate section that has Alicia Vikander playing a second role and Dol Edgerton just has no purpose. It adds nothing to the film. And not only adds nothing to the film, it feels totally all wrong. It feels like we've wandered into a Monty Python sketch and you're expecting the Holy Grail coconuts to come along any minute. And while there have been moments of absurdity up until then, that it just completely kind of loses the run of itself. There's a good half hour there that we could have said goodbye to. And lost nothing at all, I think.
Yeah, Barry Keoghan's character, Scavenger, Dev Patel meets Gawain, has several encounters with him. And let's listen to one where he's asking for directions, quite simply.
If you follow that for a day and a half, you'll come to a chapel. At least I think it's a chapel. It's not green on the whole, but I mean, it's definitely greenish with the moss and the rots and the ruins, but perhaps it's what you seek.
The stream is yonder.
It's this way, past the field where the forest meets.
I will seek it out. My thanks to you.
My thanks to you. Come on. And my directions not worth anything to you?
My thanks.
I said, are my directions not worth anything to you? I mean, a knight like you could spare a wretch like me just a small act of kindness.
Here, kindness.
Oh, Northlight. See?
Thank you.
Remember the stream.
I will.
Because it gets tricky.
That's Barry Keoghan and Dev Patel there in the scene from The Green Knight. It strikes me listening to that clip again, Justin, that it's almost as if he stuck too rigidly to the words that need to be said, which are fine when you're reading them, but it takes a long time for those to be turned into action.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, I think a good 40 minutes could have come off this film. I think it's 75, 80 minutes, especially the last, there's a last section that is really, really good, but it just meanders and not, you know, there's films that unfold slowly and it's like luxurious and you love them. And this misses, it just misses that. I really think he needed someone in the edit suite with him to help.
Stars from you, Justin.
Look, there's some great craft, costumes, cinematography. I mean, the green of Ireland is amazing and it's some great performances, but I can't go higher than two.
Yeah, is you in the same boat, Tara? Does it just take too long to do what it does?
Well, I love the final 20 minutes. I love little things like Sarita Chowdhury's Morgana. Like, she's what I would have gone back and had a whole sitcom series with her. And again, like, production design, costume, absolutely fabulous. I'll say three.
Three, okay. But certainly less is more, which is what both of you are saying in the case of The Green Knight. Let's move on to our final film then, The Alpinist documentary from director Peter Mortimer, focusing on an extraordinary young solo rock and ice climber, Marc-André Leclerc. It seems to elicit a certain amount of awe in his peers for his constant pushing of the boundaries of his discipline. I watched some of this and, to be honest, my heart was in my mouth for the entire thing. Just explain the way that Marc-André Leclerc climbs, because I'm frightened even describing it now, thinking of it.
It's unbelievable. He has these ice picks in each hand because he does this hybrid climbing. So he works in the rocks and then he goes over to ice. And so he can climb these things that people have never climbed before. In particular, there's kind of a big set piece in Patagonia and he even films part of himself. But he has these two ice picks and he just, you know, hits it in the ice and when he feels comfortable, he just lets go of like everything.
And he's swinging, hanging this ice. Yeah.
And he swings over and then he does it again. And he kind of, sometimes he's going up and sometimes it's right to left. He's trying to find another crevice to go up. But I was like, I found a couple of times, I was holding my breath. Like, I'm watching a movie and I'm actually so filled with anticipation and a kind of looming dread that I couldn't believe it was happening.
But it is a movie. It's a documentary movie. So everything we're seeing actually happened. There are no special effects per se here. This is as he actually did it. And he's a very interesting character because you think, well, there must be a kind of a wildness in him. But in fact, there's a real calmness in him.
He regards it. I mean, it's very interesting because if you remember a couple of years ago, Free Solo came out and that became the movie against all odds because it was a National Geographic documentary. But it featured Alex Honnold's record-breaking climb in Yosemite National Park, and that was horrible. I mean, I watched all of that film through my fingers, and that was a walk in the park beside this film, an absolute walk in the park. And it's interesting that Alex Honnold's voice is the first thing that you hear in this film, and this is the climber that makes him watch things through his fingers. So praise from Caesar. I mean, you can't say anything more scary than that. It's very, very. He's a really interesting character. He's obviously very clever, but he's almost like a kind of Buddhist monk. I mean, you very often with those kind of guys, you know, those kind of particular extreme sports, there's sort of real bros and you're expecting them to, you know, go surfing, you know, on a volcano and all those kind of daredevil things. And he's absolutely the opposite. He regards it as being one with the mountain, as being one with nature, as an extension of himself. And I think he's a really positive influence to actually be around and watch on a screen for a couple of hours, even without the excitement of watching him climb.
Let's listen to him describe what rock climbing is for him, I guess.
When I'm soloing rock climbs, I don't really like to feel like I'm pushing myself. Like, that's not the reason for soloing rock for me. I don't like to feel like I'm doing something intense and scary.
So then why do it?
More just to have a casual, fun adventure and cruise around.
And when you watch him climb, he's just magic on the rock. He's got style, he doesn't lunge. He's very precise. And there's not the slightest margin for error from the minute you set off, is there?
And you can hear in the voice of that final climber that we hear there from the Alpinist just how they really do watch Marc-André with real reverence, I suppose, Justin, is the only way you could put it.
Yeah, no, I mean, he takes on these challenges that people thought were impossible. You know, he prepares from like Patagonia he'd been dreaming about for a year. And he goes down there, he finds a weather window, he fails the first time. And he's filming this insane snowstorm on this mountain. And he's just, and in the morning, like as you were saying, when he gets to the bottom, he's all like, yeah, that was bad. I thought I was going to get blown off. Like he's all relaxed. And, but yeah, he just does these things. And he does it, I think, with such humility that that has an added attraction for them. He's not all over Instagram. It's kind of a few posts here and there, and people almost find them by accident that he's done these climbs.
No phone, no car, hitchhikes his way to do the big climbs. An amazing character. Mm-hmm. Without saying too much, you'll be sad by the end of the movie, though.
Yeah. And it's interesting that like most people know him through his girlfriend, I suppose, because otherwise he's glad. And what's very, and we should say, he disappears off halfway through the movie, and they're looking around going, where's the guy we're making a movie about? And then goes off and does the most insane climbs of his life while the poor filmmakers are left driving around mountains, random mountains, looking for him.
He's a solo climber. He doesn't like people watching him. He does it for himself. He doesn't do it for the cameras. You both enjoyed this. Stars from you first this time, Tara?
Oh, four.
Four from you. And what are you saying, Justin?
Yeah, no, an easy four, but... Yeah, sad in its way.
I think people who know the story will know why, but it's well worth watching just to see it if you don't know it. The Alpinist, the final movie we were speaking about there, and before that, The Green Knight and The Many Saints of Newark. Two films that Tara Brady and Justin McGregor were speaking to us about on this Thursday evening. In September 1991, Seattle-based band Nirvana released Smells Like Teen Spirit, lead single from their second album, Nevermind. It began to dominate the airwaves and the video was on heavy rotation on MTV. This Friday marks the 30th anniversary of that album, which materialised almost out of nowhere, but eventually dislodged Michael Jackson's Dangerous at the top of the album charts. Nevermind went on to sell over 30 million copies. Nobody saw that coming, not even the band's record company, who had predicted maybe 50,000 in sales. So why did this album become the huge success it did? Here to answer that question for me, our journalist John Marr and RTE's education correspondent Emma O'Kelly. But before we talk anything about the album, let's listen to that opening track and that lead sing. It really is that little guitar. I don't know what you call it. It's not a guitar riff as such, John. What would you, John Marr, how would you refer to that little twang on the guitar that we hear?
I think Butch Vig, the producer, employed every bit of studio trickery he could to kind of employ not just a kind of a guitar twang, but also the Kurt Cobain vocal to kind of be in synthesis at that very moment. But it's one of the many great moments of Nevermind.
You know, it really almost defines that album, that little bit of guitar for me.
Tell us about the video which went along with this, because that really was very much part of, John, the MTV rotation, constant rotation, and putting this album into a new place for Nirvana.
It absolutely was. A guy called Samuel Bayer, was his first video that he ever made. And he had the idea that he would reference a cult film called Over the Edge from 1979, which takes place in a posh neighbourhood in America, and at the end the kids all riot. And he had this idea, let's have this comparatively obscure band, Nirvana, one album to their name, play in front of bleachers full of kids. And there was a few flyers went out in Los Angeles. Would you like to be part of this video by this new rock band, Nirvana? So about 100 people turns up. The interesting thing is that this happened on the 17th of August, 91, and a few days later, the band got in the plane, came to Europe, and began their European tour supporting Sonic Youth in Sir Henry's in Cork before heading to Dublin. So the video was made literally a couple of days before that, and people that were at the show had no idea about what was to unfold.
Well, let's talk to one of the people who was at
was
the
one
show.
Of those people who'd no idea.
Emma O'Kelly. So you were there, Emma, not particularly for Nirvana.
No, we were there for Sonic Youth, 100% for Sonic Youth. I went with my brother Owen, who was in a band in Limerick at the time, the Hitchers. Owen told me last night that we were outside just as Nirvana began, and somebody said to him, "No, go in for this act because they're really good." So we went in. I'd love to say I heard them and thought, right, this band is going to be huge, but I actually don't. I don't remember any details about the night. I remember it was a brilliant night. I remember we danced our heads off. I kept the ticket.
I was going to say,
here.
Yeah, because people will say, Emma O'Kelly is not going to say she was one of the people, because anybody you talk to, oh yeah, I was in Sir Henry's, or oh yeah, I saw them in Dublin. And you think, that's about 5,000 people who were at those gigs, where there were really only a couple of hundred people at both gigs, really.
Yes, well, I kept the ticket, and I think possibly the reason, I wonder why I kept the ticket, and I imagine it is because it was such a good night. But for me, it's very hard to talk about Nirvana without talking about the whole kind of the milieu that they came from. And like, it was, we were there for Sonic Youth. It was Sonic Youth, it was the Pixies, it was That Petrol Emotion, it was Therapy, it was the Breeders. And you mentioned the guitar in Smells Like Teen Spirit. For us, it was all about that heavy guitar sound, the guitar sounds, that kind of messiness, loudness, the trashiness, the craziness of the guitar sound of what later became grunge.
Yeah. Well, maybe what do you think, to put it in a social context then, what was grunge kind of kicking against, if you like? Because even a track like Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know, socially, what was that movement, and stylistically, what was it trying to do?
You know, all I can think of is sort of it in very abstract times. But I think the early 90s was a very pent up time for young people in Ireland. It was that heavy, crazy guitar felt incredibly liberating. It really felt like it was plumbing down into something deep inside you and releasing it. It was raw, it was exuberant, it was messy as well. I know there was great, there was great technique in this band, in Nirvana, also bands like Sonic Youth, but it didn't feel like it was technically perfect, and it didn't feel like it was about that. It was completely and utterly liberating. It felt like a loss of control and a big roar or scream or yell.
I think that word messy is perfect there, because actually if you look at the big bands of the late 80s, this idea of hair metal bands and corporate rock, it was all so stylized and almost cartoonish at one point. I mean, much as I enjoy Guns N' Roses, I mean, there was a lot of nonsense going on there, and it felt really removed from where most people were. And suddenly this band comes along. They're from Kurt Cobain from Aberdeen outside Seattle, so a small logging town, very much away from anywhere that was cool and contrived, and it just felt visceral. And Bleach, the debut album, is exceptionally visceral. And even though this is much more polished, there is still something incredibly energetic and real about it. There's a howl from the heart that really spoke to me as a 16-year-old, I have to say.
And maybe is there something about Seattle, being kind of at the centre of all of this? Is it that kind of, you know, nowhere town where it rains all the time? No wonder the teenagers wanted to scream and shout loudly as Nirvana taught them how to do it.
Yes, and you mentioned the video. I was watching the video, and like those kids looked like us, and there was that whole thing about the image as well. I mean, they looked like us, their hair was like ours, they didn't go to hairdressers, they cut their own hair maybe, their clothes were the clothes we wore our friend's brother's jumper because he had left it behind and you liked the colour of it or something. It was before fast fashion, you had worn out t-shirts, you had jeans, faded jeans. It later then, and partly because of the success of Nirvana, it became packaged and it became, a label was slapped on it. It was called grunge. But for us, it was just, it was the way we were. And that, they were giving that back to us. They were reflecting that.
Polly, John, tell us about this track on the album.
Well, this is one of the more restrained tracks on the album. And I think one of the the beautiful things about Nevermind is that there's enormous variety to it. Polly is also about sensitivity, and Kurt Cobain was, you know, very much in touch with his feminine side, and I don't just mean that flippantly. He really cared about not being the typical macho man in rock. I mean, famously, Nirvana, you know, in the liner notes of one of their albums, I think it was In Utero, their final album, said, you know, any homophobes, please do not follow us, do not come to see us in concert. Anybody who hates women, don't come to see us. And he wrote about people in bad places, as I suppose Polly represents to a degree. But I always felt that there was an element of hope, even among the darkness or amid the darkness.
And I love the fact that this is the acoustic guitar that we're dealing with here, as opposed to maybe the kind of, it's not wall of sound, but that big loud sound that we get in some of the other tracks.
A cracker, think I should get off her first. Think she wants some water to put out the blowtorch. Isn't me, have a seat. Let me clip dirty wings. Let me take a ride. Cut yourself. Want some help?
There's Polly from Nirvana and the album whose the 30th anniversary of which we're celebrating tonight, Nevermind, with Emma O'Kelly and John Marr. And we were saying, you had said earlier, Emma, about this idea that, yeah, they could play. And that acoustic track really shows that for me.
Yeah, absolutely. They didn't, I mean, in their kind of heavy, trashy guitar explosions, you loved the sense of lack of control. But of course, I mean, they were technically brilliant. And as you said, the delicacy of that acoustic there really shows that they were obviously technically hugely proficient.
I suppose that is the thing about grunge. It's the blurriness and the mashiness. You still have to hear the music, and that's the challenge of it, really, in some ways. But for all we're talking about it tonight, John, and of course 30 years later, we can all say what a hugely important album was and what a hugely successful album it was. It didn't immediately splash into success.
Not at all. It was a very, very slow build. The video was sent to MTV shortly after it was completed, and they just sat on it for ages, for 3-4 weeks. And then they played it on one of their late night programs, and there was a really good response to it, and slowly rolled it out onto kind of daytime, their daytime platform. And it just captured something, and as Emma said, you know, the people could relate to it. They saw themselves in the look of it, and also the song "Smells Like Teen Spirit" is so brilliant. It's such a brilliant song. Every second of it, that opening guitar riff, and it just grabs you. And I remember for me, when Nirvana, I mean, I'd heard Dave Fanning play Nirvana a number of times, but when it really connected with me was a Friday night at home in Tipperary watching The Word on Channel 4, which is always a great thing for controversy and for amazing performances. And I think it was Terry Christian presenting, who just at the end of the show, here's Nirvana, this great band with Smells Like Teen Spirit. And it just was this incredible performance. Just remarkable. And even to look at it again, and it's up there on YouTube, it's so brilliantly filmed as well. Like, it's so exciting. And I can't think of a music TV programme, with the exception of Jules's later perhaps, where the energy of the live performance is conveyed so brilliantly. And at 16, looking at this, like it really was my version of how people felt in 1972 watching David Bowie and Mick Ronson do Starman on Top of the Pops. It was that important.
Yeah. You were saying, Emma, too, that, you know, you felt that when you looked at these people, you kind of could see yourself. You could see yourself and your friends reflected in what they were wearing, in the way they were behaving, and the kind of energy that they exuded on stage. Was that very different from, say, something like Sonic Youth or something like the Pixies?
No, I see it very much in the same same thing. Absolutely. I mean, they were part of that scene to me, just like Sonic Youth, just like the Pixies. They looked like us. They reflected us. And John mentioned about femininity as well, and that's an important thing that I was actually just thinking about recently, because I mean, the other two bands that I mentioned there, of course, they had female, you know, heavy guitarists. Nirvana didn't but still you had this sense that it wasn't a macho thing. It was loud, it was brash, it was full of energy, but it was for everybody. It was for us as well as young women, as girls.
Yeah, you weren't being excluded. Not. Well, I'll let you choose which track we'll finish up with then. In Bloom or Lithium? Would you choose between
Lithium? It's hard to choose between the two. Yeah.
Okay, Lithium. I mean, where does this sit with John within the album? Would you say Lithium?
Oh, it's first of all, it's one of the, I'm pretty sure it's one of the singles. Yeah, it was the third single released in July 92, so a long time after the album came out. It's one of those pivotal tracks along with In Bloom. I mean, I'll be honest, I think there are some skippable moments at the very end of the album, but that felt essential. Mm. Like it was a big sound again, an impressive video to accompany it, and a sense that. But certainly by the time that single was released, they were huge. Like they were probably the biggest band on the planet, and this was just a coronation.
Lithium, the track that we're about to listen to from Nevermind, 30th anniversary of which we've been celebrating this evening with John Maher and Emma O'Kelly.
I'm not scared, light my candles in our days, 'cause I found God.
Lithium from Nirvana, from the album Nevermind, which celebrates its 30th anniversary this year. Five years ago, Niall Henry and Blue Raincoat Theatre Company created Shackleton, an extraordinary production about the famous Irish explorer and his ill-fated 1914 expedition to the Antarctic. During his research on Shackleton, Niall Henry came across another intriguing, almost forgotten story, that of three explorers in 1911 on another Antarctic expedition, this time with Captain Scott, who set off on a mini-adventure of their own to retrieve an egg from an emperor penguin. Hunting Darwin is Blue Raincoat's new show, opening next week in Sligo to live audiences. Delighted to have Niall Henry join us from Sligo this evening. Where did you find this story, first of all, Niall? Where did you find it? Tell me that.
Hello, Sean. It was when we were reading research in Shackleton, there was, a lot of the books would be fairly boring, daring do white men from the early 20th century. And there was a guy called Apsley Cherry Garrard who wrote a book called The Worst Journey in the World, and he was with Scott, and it was probably the only good book, if not brilliant book, and in that there was a chapter called A Winter's Journey, and it was about himself, a guy called Gordon Wilson, who was Scott's right-hand man, and a guy called Bertie Bowers, who headed off in the middle of the like all of those things that happened with the South Pole all happened in the Antarctic summer. They actually headed off in the middle of winter, so you can imagine what the weather was like, be worse than Leitrim and Sligo, and they headed off. They actually travelled 1.1 miles a day, that's all they could do, and pitch dark, to get the eggs. And the reason for the eggs was because Darwin, which wasn't that long before that, and they were trying to prove the theory of evolution.
And so they obviously had very, there was this side, yes, there was the daring do thing that went on with these explorers, but there was also a very scientific side to many of the minds of these people and these men.
Yeah, some of them. That was Scott's second expedition, but he really only wanted to get there because Shackleton got close enough to the South Pole. And he went, his right-hand guy, as I said, Gordon Wilson, was a doctor and been with him the first time. And Scott wanted him to go the second time, and he wouldn't go. He had got married and moved to Wiltshire and settled down and opened a practice. Scott begged him, and so he went. But he went purely on the proviso that he could lead a mini expedition to go and get these eggs, to get the emperor penguin eggs.
And that's what I mean about those eggs. Were they interested in getting these for financial gain? Or were they interested purely in scientific terms?
No, Wilson was purely interested scientifically. You're right, if they could prove the link, for whatever reason they thought they could prove the link between birds and dinosaurs, and that would be sort of another box ticked in proving Darwin's theory.
I don't know if you want to give us, I suppose, this history as to whether they got the egg or not.
What they did? Yeah.
And to what extent within the play then what are you exploring? Because we know the ending in that respect. Yes, they succeeded in getting the egg. What are you looking at in terms of the show?
That's a good question. And I probably should have a quick answer, and I don't. You always ask the easy question, Sean. When we did Shackleton, the thing that had struck me most of all was your man Hurley's photographs. Just these extraordinary photographs of the Antarctic landscape with just, you know, human beings on it and nothing there, and one hand beautiful and the other hand it was a wasteland. When we were reading around that, I really mean the books were, one was more boring than the next, but you were really wading through the books, and in many cases you wonder why you were bothering, but I suppose in some sense you're hoping that there'll be something in the background of your mind that'll pick up stuff that'll be useful. But the one that kept popping up was this one, The Worst Journey. And the Apsley was an extraordinary guy in that. To answer the question, I have to go a slight sidebar, sure. Sean, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
He was on the second last team with Scott the following year after the eggs. And when they found Scott and Captain Oates and all of them, and Wilson and Bowers, the two guys who went on the egg hunt with Apsley, actually died with Scott. And they opened Scott's diary, and Scott said in his diary, intimated in his diary, that the second last team had taken too much of the paraffin or whatever fuel they were using in the dumps. So he was blackballed completely in England. And of course, science proved years later that actually all it was that the cold was such that it had decimated, or the seals had disintegrated and it had evaporated. So he hadn't. So he was blackballed when he had gone back after, never mind the egg, but having gone nearly to the South Pole with Scott. He was only sort of 24, 25 years old. But his next door neighbour was George Bernard Shaw. And George Bernard Shaw asked him to, encouraged him to write the book to tell his side of the story. So he just told his side of the story. He was extraordinarily sensitive and I'm going to say poetic, but that's the wrong word. But he was capable of conveying this sentiment that he felt on his adventures, where an awful lot of the other accounts weren't able, or at least the ones that I was able to find read weren't able.
So in some ways, are you reclaiming Apsley's character, or giving Apsley a chance for his character to be, you know, rejuvenated, if you like, and that blackballing that went on during his life to be corrected?
I don't know if a little theatre company, a little Sligo and a little West of Ireland and a little Europe is able to do something as big as that, but I suppose when I read it way back then, it just felt like it's 5 years since Shackleton, which is probably too close, but you know, you just really wanted to do it. You felt for him. Like many extraordinary things and extraordinary feat what they did, this one was particularly absurd. Yeah. You know,
and obviously you've had the experience with Shackleton of representing, you know, this type of Antarctic expedition. Physicality is going to be hugely important here. You said you read lots of boring books. you are not a wordy theatre company in that respect. I'm guessing that this will be highly visual and highly physical.
Well, the books that I read about Antarctica written by those guys were boring. It's not that all books are boring. it's a very visual piece. We have decided to do it as a shadow puppet theatre. No. And so that was sort of the way we did it when we started doing Shackleton, or in many ways when we started doing any of the things we devised, Sean, you're sort of trying to find a way to do them as well, to like a type of theatre that you think might suit the story you want to tell. You
know? And what is it about the shadow puppet form that you think is useful in the telling of this particular tale?
Again, good question, and I am not sure. But one of the things with the pandemic last year, we did a few shows last year that got cancelled at the last minute. And so when you were putting a programme together, of stuff for this year. You wanted to make sure everything that was on the list you were able to do. So like everybody, we did online things and did film things and did outdoor stuff, and we do a good bit of work with Tread Softly here. But when it got to that, we still won't be able to. We have a small theatre and we can't have capacity. Mm. So the show's about 45 minutes long, so we'll be able to have two shows a night. You know, came up with the idea to shadow puppetry, I don't really know. You know what I mean? And to be honest with you, we know nothing about shadow puppetry.
I was going to ask you that as well. You know, have you had to take the crash course in shadow puppetry to learn the techniques and to learn how you might express this story through that medium?
Yeah, but it always feels like a crash course, Sean. Do you know what I mean? I don't know when it doesn't. You know what I mean? You know?
And will there be music involved here?
There is. Yeah, Joe Hunt is doing the sound design. There's some music involved. I suppose Bob Kelly has done text for it. Jamie Vartan is designing. So there's a very good team of people involved, you know, in terms of assembling it.
Yeah, and a good story to be told. Not in the boring way that some, and as in some of the books that you read.
Yeah, I hope.
Well, listen, thanks, Niall. Thanks for telling us about it this evening. That's Niall Henry there of Sligo's Blue Raincoat Theatre Company. And Hunting Darwin is at the Factory Performance Space in Sligo from the 29th of September through until the 9th of October. And you can find out further details at blueraincoat.com. And that is our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again. 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.